Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
And welcome to Idle Red Hands, I'm Bane.
You beat me to it, Chris.
I'm also Bane.
I had my glass ready.
I'm Wayne.
Oh, it's geez. The Bane and Wayne show.
And here I thought you two had gotten that out of your system before we started recording. As long as I've known you guys, I should have known better. Jeez.
I'm actually Chris. That's my secret identity.
Yeah, so we're talking about Bane, Brian.
Who'd have thunk?
We're talking about Bane Cat and Bane and just Bane's voice.
I thought you were talking about Bane Cat.
Okay. You guys were listening, so I consider that we were talking.
All right.
Anything other than Bane going on?
Well, I suppose, with the whole Batman franchise, the new Batman versus Superman movie is going to be coming out.
Yeah, I think the latest news is they've cast Aquaman.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be Jason Momoa or Khal Drogo.
Yes.
Right.
And thank God they cast cameraman number one. Got that done. George Cedar.
How can you make a film without cameraman number one?
Yeah, or drone pilot.
Yeah. That's going to be weird, huh? That the Aquaman's going to be bigger and buffer than Superman, huh?
Well, they'll probably pad out Superman.
Hey, they got the girl from The Wolverine, Tao Okamoto.
Was she good? I didn't see it.
Ooh.
That's a
actually
no.
She wasn't bad. She's a model turned actress, so. I think Wonder Woman's the Gail Gadot. I think she's a model turned actress as well.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, but yeah, Batman versus Superman, but then we also have Aquaman, Wonder Woman, and Cyborg.
So it's Justice League.
Yeah, Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, so why don't we just call it Justice League.
Mm, right. Yeah.
Dawn of Justice. I mean, you tack some people on in the second movie or whatever, if that's why they're holding back. And...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think as Chris said before we started recording, like the title, subtitle is the way movies are going now. I mean, it could have been Batman vs. Superman 4 or Justice League 5 or whatever, but I think for whatever reason, movie studios don't like to just tack a number onto the end. Although, that is thoroughly debunked with the Fast and the Furious series.
Well, they probably wouldn't want to call it Justice League 4 because there hasn't been a Justice League 1, 2, or 3.
Mm. You got my point, Mr. Pedantic.
No, but they could have done the colon thing for this. They could have got Justice League, Dawn of Justice. Then the second one would have been Justice League...
Day of Justice.
Day of Justice.
Afternoon of Justice.
Right, yeah. Right.
Brunch of Justice.
Dessert of Dust Justice.
Late dinner of justice.
Yeah. Just desserts.
Justice desserts. Justice desserts. What are you talking about? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I, being the air quote comic book person that I am, I haven't ever watched any of the Batman versus Superman things. So in my mind, it's just going to be Batman running away a lot until he manages to get some kryptonite.
I don't know. The animated series, I never saw the comics, but the animated series did it really well, when they fought. I remember this one scene, it was really cool, where Batman was, beating up some kind of a thug, and Superman comes up to him, puts a hand on his shoulder, and says, "I won't have any vigilantism in my town." Batman just kind of looks at his hand, and the next thing you see is Superman going through a table, kind of like implying that he used some kind of martial arts or something on him. And then it was just kind of their back and forth tit and tat. The Superman used X-ray vision to find out that he was Bruce Wayne, but Batman snuck a tracker device onto Superman, so he found out that he was Clark Kent. And it was cool.
Yeah, the ones I've read, there's one showdown in Hush, there's one in Dark Knight Returns, but yeah, they involved kryptonite.
That's kind of what I figured, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I've seen plenty of internet debates on it, and a lot of people saying, that while Superman might be the most powerful person in the DC universe, Batman is probably one of the most intelligent. So it's not so much a fight face-to-face, it's that Batman would always be prepared to be able to deal with Superman's powers, and that's why they're some kind of a good match. Or at least that's the internet theory.
Yeah, fair enough, because we always know the internet is always right.
Yes. I trust it.
Well, I mean, there's not going to be much fighting, really. There'll be that one scene of them fighting, and then they realize that Lex Luthor and other people are worse. I wonder if they'll end up fighting like Aquaman until they don't, and Wonder Woman until they don't.
So kind of like the Avengers.
Yeah, just, we just meet each other. Fuck! It's on.
Until it's not. When does that come out over here in Japan?
2016.
Oh, all right. Fair enough.
Who knows when?
Oh, yeah. 2016?
I actually just threw a number out jokingly. I don't know when it actually
is. No, it's May 6, 2016 in the U.S.
Oh, crap.
But we were looking at Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Hey, another Dawn movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to come out in July in the United States.
Hmm.
And it's going to come out in September in Japan, well after Latvia, Azerbaijan, Qatar.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So look forward to our review of it sometime around Christmas.
Right.
Wow, what's with Japan?
I don't know. It's not as if they can't get movies at the same time, as Avengers proved.
It probably just has something to do with the market. The more international hype there is to a movie, the more Japanese people go and see it.
Oh, maybe. I think we had this discussion before.
They tried it out with the Avengers, where they tried releasing it around the world first to build up hype and then releasing it in America afterwards, but they haven't done that since. So I'm thinking that maybe that tactic didn't work very well.
Maybe.
Do you think Japanese people are like waiting to see how the Qatar audience is going to react to the movie?
The Qatar audience, no, but maybe the worldwide showing of it there, or the reviews therein.
The Latvians know their monkey movies. So we'll see if they have success there.
I mean, no, it's a box office hit, but really, what did Qatar think of it?
That's the thing. You're laughing, but now you'll get to know.
So for gaming news, I ended up buying another Kickstarter game called The God's Fall.
And you got it in it like right before it closed too, didn't you?
5 hours before it closed.
Wow, nice.
I found out about it 5.5 hours before it closed.
Hmm. And is that good that you jumped in right away?
Yeah, it checked a lot of boxes. It had a really good art.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting premise. It's a post-apocalyptic game. And then this is something that Wayne would be interested in, is that they have done everything. They've already bought the art and commissioned the art. They've already written and playtested the material. Mm. They've already picked the printer. So they listed, these are all the things, like, you know, under the risks,
mm-hmm.
like the caveat part. And they said, well, this is what we've got, and these things could happen. And then you're reading them, and they're joking about it. They're like, okay, if our computer crashes, we have it on another backed up on another computer. If that crashes as well, then it's in the clouds. If the internet goes down, then Cthulhu doesn't want us to make this book. And just stuff like that. So it was pretty funny, and their video was a little funny, so I supported them.
Hmm. No, look, it looks really interesting. I mean, they say that the system is pretty simple and straightforward, and, you know, you can make a character relatively quickly, because it's all about kind of getting to play, you know, and which seems to be the way RPGs are going now. You know, you just kind of want to get up and running in as little time as possible, rather mm-hmm. than, you know, spending hours or days making a character.
Right.
But no, and Lyle's absolutely right. Like for me, having everything done and just needing printing costs or art commission costs, I'm much more likely to back a Kickstarter like that than mm-hmm. one that is still in the process, or the process of writing has not even been started.
Right.
And D&D news, because we all know how much I love D&D. Newest article is about kind of the storyline for the Tyranny of Dragons for 5th edition, and I don't know. I was trying to wrap my head around how you can have kind of a storyline and a narrative arc for a role-playing game that wouldn't just be a series of linked adventure modules, or that wouldn't be something that, like, Margaret Weiss Productions did for Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, where it's just, you already know this story, we're expecting you to kind of play this story pretty much as is, and do something like that.
Is that the case? Is that the way it is?
Well, I don't know what it is.
Oh, okay.
Because
but you're assuming it's bad.
No. I'm saying I don't know how you can have a narrative arc in a role-playing game product unless it is something like those two things I just mentioned.
Well, I mean, they have other games, like Forgotten Realms, for example, that they have their own kind of story meta, and then you play in the world with that meta evolving through. I'm not particularly a big fan of that kind of thing, but that's another way that you could have a running story, but also still have adventurers going through it.
Yeah, I mean, you could have it for their official kind of, like, encounter, programs or their Friday night whatever, where, these are the little linked adventure modules you're going to play through, and at the end of the season, you're going to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
But the article seemed to imply that that's going to be happening everywhere, both at a store, at official kind of like Gen Con events, and you'd have the ability to do that at home. And I'm like, okay, I personally wouldn't want to play someone else's story at home. And also, mm-hmm. I don't really understand how you could not enforce that, but how you could do that to the point where they said a character playing in any of these official adventure things, regardless of where that is going to be able to play in any other of these official things, regardless of where that is. So as long as I'm playing this module, even at home, I could then take my character to a Gen Con event and it would still be legal.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that sounds like it would be a lot of bookkeeping or a lot of rules restrictions on what I can build my character at and what things I can have. And
well, I mean,
not necessarily. It'd just be like whatever your level is, then is what you can carry over.
Mm-hmm.
What they're doing, it sounds like what they're doing is something similar to what BattleTech did. I don't know if I don't think they do it anymore, but they would get somebody like Michael Stackpole, and he would sort of map out what is going to be the overarching story that's going to be told.
Right.
And then they parcel out, he would write the core books in that story, and then other people would write, not filler stories, but things that fill in the gaps. And then the game narrative would also be related to that story. I'm thinking, like, for example, with the clans, when the clans came in to BattleTech. So they're going to release gaming products that introduce the clan mechs and who the clans are, as well as that kind of information, as well as how the Inner Sphere responded. And then you can read all these novels about it. Mm-hmm. And looking at this, what they're doing is they're doing something similar. But I'm guessing they're also thinking along the lines of what Magic does. So they're, I'll say, sister game, whereas they have blocks.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne, what is it? Blocks and sets or sets of blocks?
I think the terminology is block. And then there's a set. There's three sets per block.
Yeah. Okay, so they're doing the blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And Tyranny of Dragons is going to be the first block for D&D, and that'll be followed by another block. So as opposed to Forgotten Realms, Greyhawk, and other game settings, Dark Sun or whatever, if you go to second edition, and they sort of coexist separately, these will be, and at the same time, these are going to be, like, Tyranny of Dragons will come out, and I'm going to guess there's going to be another block or another storyline will come out, and then they'll release all the cool books, miniatures, and games that relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I can see the economic sense in it, in that they're trying to reset the game
right. Without
resetting the edition.
No, that's a good point. I wonder if everything would happen in the Forgotten Realms setting, because they've pretty much said that that is the default setting for Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition. I mean, that's of course they're going to come out with, you know, stuff for the other supported worlds, but I wonder if I'm pretty sure the bulk of whatever blocks they put out would be for Forgotten Realms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at least they'll probably concentrate on this, but yeah, I don't know.
Hmm. I was talking to someone the other day, and as usual, bemoaning the fact that D&D looks pretty much like it's always looked, which I understand that's what WotC had to do, but at the same time, I would like to see something different. And I had also used Magic as a really good example of every block feels like Magic, but every block is still slightly tweaked and different and feels kind of fresh and new, but at the same time not being so completely different that you don't know how to play.
Well, I'm going to disagree there.
Okay.
Because we played the latest block for Magic, and then I was telling Chris about it, how it was sort of like a Greek mythology flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were saying, which block was that? And I said, the one we played today.
Right, so but I'm not talking about flavor. I'm not talking about flavor. I'm talking about mechanics, purely from a mechanical sense.
Oh, mechanical sense. Oh, okay,
right?
I see.
Sorry,
I thought you meant from a visual.
No, sorry. You were talking about flavor before, so sorry for the confusion. But
okay,
I would like to see something like that happen with Dungeons & Dragons, where enough of this is the same, where you're going to know how to play, but enough of it is going to be different where it doesn't feel like we're just kind of doing the same thing again.
So, like, redefining the character classes or races or something like that?
Something. Something. Mm-hmm. They fell flat on their face with 4E because it was different.
Too different, yeah.
Right. So I understand them going back to something safe, but I don't know. At the same time, like, looking through the spell list and everything that they've put up for the previews, I'm like, I've seen all of this before in every previous edition.
But that's what this edition is. It was like, hey, sorry, we tried to do something different.
Yeah, this is Dungeons & Dragons, the apology edition.
Yeah,
yeah. So
that's a good way of putting it, actually.
So they're going to try to make it as D&D-esque as they can. Right. So they're going to try to make it look as samey as they can.
Right.
And the takesy backsy
they realize
edition.
That these people that complain about that don't buy a lot of product after the initial releases, then they're trying to think of something else that they can do. And yeah, they're trying to do this.
Hey, you know what? You putting it the block idea, that makes a lot of sense.
I guess so. That's what I'm guessing. Reading it, that's my take on it. I initially had another, I thought something else, and that was along the lines of the Living Greyhawk or what Torg did.
Right.
Where people played, and then they sent in what the results of their play, and that shaped the story.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But this just seems like, oh, no, we've just kind of all planned it all together, and we'll release it.
Yeah. Because it sounds like they're just properly writing it out, the story, as is, without even thinking about the encounters and mechanics first.
Oh, yeah, they might be. They might be.
Which power to them, you know? I mean, make a good story first and then flesh it out from there. But
I guess I'd like to see how it works. But you talking about adventures, that reminded me, the two starting adventures for 5th edition were not written by Wizards of the Coast. They outsourced them to Kobold Press.
That's right. Yeah, I heard about that.
They were talking, in his article, Mike Morales was talking about how Kobold Press handled everything, even down to layout and art commission, and how he was really happy with, you know, how smoothly that went and how it all looks. And, well, obviously it struck me as being kind of new, and he said that freed up the core D&D team to work on, you know, fixing up the base rules and not having to worry about running an adventure at the same time and, you know, kind of not splitting the work pool. But reading that, I'm like, so you're still working on rules, and don't you kind of have to have most of the, if not all of the rules in place before you can write an adventure?
Maybe, but really. It could also be where they have the core rules down, but they're balancing out kind of the higher level stuff to see if it, and playtesting that.
Yeah.
And the adventures written are only for levels 1 through 4, something like that. As one idea.
But. Right. Well, the starter box does only go up to 5. Mm-hmm. Only takes you to level 5, so.
No, you know, I'm also thinking like Pathfinder does their adventure pass.
Written by other people?
No, sorry. This is going back to the block idea.
Right.
So.
Yeah, you're right. It's a different line of meta, but like you were saying, it's not different mechanically, though.
No, but I mean,
I don't think this is going to be different mechanically. I think these are just going to be storylines.
Right, right. No, and I see what Lyle is saying. This is kind of a way for them to sell product without having to reset the edition every time they do it. It's like, great, you love the Tyranny of Dragons block, so now here's the, you know, I don't know, Fatality and Faerun block, whatever. You know, now here's this other story arc. So, yeah, I could see that working. Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, I'm saying it seems to be working for Pathfinder.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
And then they've tied their adventure card game series to the blocks. They're behind, but Rise of the Rune Lords,
right?
I believe was the first adventure path for Pathfinder, and then that was the first adventure path for the adventure card game. So that's got to catch up. But then, I mean, and they've got the miniatures line and everything. So I imagine that there's some synergy going on there.
Mm-hmm. Well, why wouldn't you do that? Because you've already produced the adventure. You've already commissioned all this art for whatever, you know, product you released a couple years in the past. So just, I mean, it sounds a little bit negative when I say recycle, but just, you know, reuse that art. You already know all the NPCs and all the stuff. So it's just kind of like getting more money out of the materials you had before. So I don't really see any problem with that from a business standpoint.
I agree.
Hey, we all agreed on something. All right.
Something just exploded somewhere.
Yeah, miraculous.
Yeah, so today's episode's going to be about transhumanism, or also posthumanism, if we want to make that distinction.
So yeah, as Lyle said, we're talking about posthumanism and transhumanism today. This was brought on by a couple of different things. We've all played and did a playtest review of Eclipse Phase in the past, and plus there's two new transhuman games out, Mindjammer and Nova Praxis, both Fate games.
Which means Lyle will never play them.
One can hope. And I've been trying to write my own transhuman game as well, so it's been on my mind of late. So yeah, we started talking about it and thought it might make a good cast.
Now, running a transhuman game can be quite a challenge, and we certainly experienced that when we played Eclipse Phase, and then we talked about that in that episode. So what we thought we'd do in this episode is come up with some questions that we think game masters, and I suppose players, need or should ask themselves if they're thinking about running a trans or posthumanism game. Mm-hmm. And some things to consider. So that's how we'll structure this, through a series of questions that you should ask yourself.
The first big question is your game about transhumanism or post-humanism?
Yes. Next question.
Yep. Oh, all right. Funny. I was going to say, as usual, there was a lot of debate and some arguing on this because, you know, genres kind of blend together. Basically, the definition of transhuman is the process of kind of transforming from human to a post-human state. And then post-humanism is obviously that more than human state. After we did the Eclipse Phase episode, I think you even brought up in that episode, Lyle, that some people call Eclipse Phase a post-human game, despite the fact that it says it's a transhuman game, only because the capabilities of your average citizen are so wildly above and beyond what 21st century humans can be. So I could see that argument.
Yeah, and I agree completely. I think Eclipse Phase is entirely a post-human game. Everyone is a genius, immortal being compared to regular humans.
Right, or has the potential to be. Yeah,
yeah. I think it's just kind of the general vernacular for post-humanism. People use the word transhuman, just from the examples that I've seen in movies and books and whatnot. And then when it comes to transhuman, people seem to call it cyberpunk. For example, Ghost in the Shell is, I think that's a transhuman thing, but it generally falls under the cyberpunk genre.
But what is the distinction that would be helpful for people? And I think we just talked about it this prior to the episode, about just how prevalent it is in society.
Yeah. When I was reading Nova Praxis, it seemed to me like a scaled down version of Eclipse Phase. Like a lot of the same technology was present. It just was not in such extensive use. So that's one way I saw to make your game a transhuman game is, you know, the technology is starting to be embraced, but most of your average citizens, you know, don't have all these kind of, for lack of a better term, superpowers, or don't have all these abilities. A few could, and of course, you know, the PCs being special, they could be ones with these cybernetic powers or whatever they are. But yeah, I would say the number of people who have these abilities would help you determine or help establish whether your game was transhuman or post-human.
Yeah, that's one of the parts that we kind of disagreed over, in that I think you mentioned it there, kind of these people with superpowers. If there's only a couple people in a game that have powers above and beyond the rest of the populace, for me that kind of falls into the superhero genre more than a transhuman one. And Lyle brought up the really good point this afternoon that Captain America or Iron Man could be considered transhumans. Or post-humans, maybe even.
Right.
And I don't want to say like that what you're saying is wrong. It's just I kind of have a different viewpoint on it.
Fair enough.
I think, yeah, another thing to think is maybe transhumanism is that people are recognizably human.
Right.
Yes, there's, yeah.
They're just enhanced in a certain way. And there's a lot of things out there. I mean, Captain America is an example of a transhuman, but he certainly is post-human. He's enhanced with the super soldier serum, but he is still very human. He identifies himself as a human.
Right.
Whereas post-human, they've redefined what it is to be human.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's a George R.R. Martin short story in the anthology Wasteland, or Wastelands. And I think that is an example of somebody who I believe would be, you describe them as post-human. They've evolved after living in a certain environment that there is that language barrier, but they also have a psychic connection to this like giant weasel-like thing.
Hmm.
So when they actually encounter humans, like actually humans who haven't evolved,
right,
then they just can't communicate.
Right. Hmm. Well, I was thinking of that story by Arthur C. Clarke, Childhood's End, where it's not necessarily or explicitly transhuman, but you know, the generation of kids just kind of reaches their evolutionary potential and just, at the end of the story, spoilers, everybody just kind of disappears because they don't need physical bodies anymore. They're just this collective consciousness. So that is radically different from human. But going back to the Iron Man, Captain America, which I think is a good analogy for transhumanism, maybe what separates superpowers from transhumanism for me is that transhuman story implies that everybody has this potential. So if Captain America was kind of manufacturing or trying to manufacture super serum so that everybody could reach that kind of next stage of evolution, or if Tony Stark was trying to find a way to manufacture Iron Man's suit so that all of humanity could reach the same stage that they were, I would see it more as transhuman. Superheroes like, these guys are special, and general population
and
will... Yeah, exactly, and the general population will never be that way, where transhuman is... Okay, we got there first, and now everybody else is going to kind of follow us up.
Yeah, I agree completely.
All right.
So I think just as far as playing the game, though, it's with transhumanism versus posthumanism, because we're not really asking whether or not they're going to be trans, post, or superheroes.
Right.
But it's just, are they identifiably human, or are they, like, really out there?
Right. So
beyond
human. And
Eclipse has some good examples. It's like you can play an octopus, and I think there was a little bit of a debate on whether or not Chris should have been allowed to play an octopus.
Right, right.
I should have been allowed to play an octopus.
Yeah. Right. Well, you had a very good point, because the scenario we played was supposed to be horror, but things were so beyond our 21st century experience that, Lyle, you said it really well. You're like, I don't know if I should be scared about this, because I don't know what is normal for this society.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think things like mutilation and death might be things that would frighten a transhuman, but probably a lot of posthumans, it wouldn't frighten them because they just put themselves in another body and re-sleeve.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Or things like that. Well, but it depends what kind of posthuman they are.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there was some examples of in the series Ilium and Olympiad, written by Dan Simmons, where you have different types of posthumans or things that could be identified as transhumans. And in some cases, I think the AI posthumans, they would be afraid of death. They can actually die.
Mm.
That's not their thing. Immortality wasn't the thing that transcended. But then you had actual gods, Greek gods, who would be posthumans. And they're there. You would have in many sense, immortal.
Mm-hmm. Right. That kind of reminds me of the Ian M. Banks culture series. Where, yeah, you can pretty much change bodies at will, and, you know, the only way to actually die is to kill a person and then kind of kill all their backups. Like, they didn't back themselves up to kind of the way they do in Eclipse Phase, but I think they called it, like, mind death, where you could, you know, capture somebody's mind at kind of the instant that they died, and they could still live in an artificial environment or in a robotic shell, and so they were still kind of technically alive. In that case, yeah, would death scare those people? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're a game master and you're kind of pressed and you haven't planned the first three sessions, you maybe just throw out this question to the players.
Mm.
And that'll can take up the whole time.
Yeah, it will. It will. Okay, great session discussing what the difference is. Yeah,
we're going to come back. I mean, there's something about Neanderthals, chimpanzees.
Right.
So we'll come back on that one. So the second question is the game about trans or post-humanism, or does it just have it? And like a sub question to that, is the game, is the question of what it means to be human such a central theme that not including it means your game is not about transhumanism?
Right.
I think this is where you can get into the, in my opinion, where it can get a little like a superhero game, or it can get like a cyberpunk or Rifts or whatever, where you have juicers like, or crazies, people that could be identified as transhuman.
Right.
But the game's not really about that. The game's really about fighting demons.
Right.
Mm. Or the game is like, Shadowrun's a good example.
Yeah.
The game is about not exploring, I'm an elf, but was I human at one point? You know, can I call myself a human? That's not really what the game's about. The game's about running, right. Doing these runs. The
game's about blowing stuff up and not getting shot and being a criminal, yeah.
Yeah, it's a clever way to have cyberpunk fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's a really good point. And I think, for me personally, that's why I wouldn't really consider Ghost in the Shell a trans or post-human setting. It kind of falls a bit more on the cyberpunk. Kind of feels like the elements are there. And I guess, well, I don't know.
Really?
Maybe I'm shooting myself in the foot here, because they do a lot with kind of, you know, what it means to be intelligent or what it means to be human.
Far too much, I think.
Yeah,
I've
just been, I'm just kind of
waxed on endlessly about philosophical crap.
Yeah, I'm misremembering that series. I'm just remembering like explosions and big robots and stuff. So never mind.
Well, using the Iron Man example from earlier. So Iron Man has a lot of suits of armor, and each one serves a purpose. and that would be how the person perceived their sleeves.
Mm-hmm. Well, each one kind of has a limited intelligence too, doesn't it? Or at least some kind of like minor AI in it so that it can, you know, fly around and follow limited commands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was thinking more in the lines of these are tools to do tasks. Yeah, but even thinking about Mission Impossible, which of course isn't a transhuman or posthumanism TV series or movie series, but they put on disguises because and they have a bunch of tools to do these missions. Mm-hmm. And that's what, how you approach it. It's like I can put on this octopus sleeve because that's going to be really good when I go out into space and have to fight.
Other space octopi, right?
No, well, I was thinking like I don't know. It seemed like that would be a good sleeve to have if you went out into space in zero gravity.
Right.
I put on an octopus sleeve because it gives me eight arms to hold guns.
Right.
You are post octopus.
Post octopus. Yeah.
three leg octopus. A three armed octopus.
Isn't it a triskelion?
It would be a troctopus.
I don't know. Tructopus, right. That's a mashup of a truck and an octopus.
Tructopus! This Wednesday at Rosemont Horizon.
Yeah. No way. A troctopus would be a mashup of a Tyrannosaurus, a crocodile, and an octopus. There you go. Troctopus.
Sunday.
You're welcome, sci-fi. But, no, I think that's a good point. You know, if you're not exploring what it means to be human and kind of these sleeves and... You know, if robots are just kind of robots like they are in the Star Wars universe and they're just objects, then you're not really exploring the question of what it means to be human.
Well, I don't know if the robots in the Star Wars universe are necessarily the robots that are in the movie series. Because the robots in the Star Wars universe can still have the depth that like an Asimov robot has.
Right.
I mean, they're sentient or...
They're a whole... I'm sorry I brought them up, because they're a whole weird thing. Like, are they slaves? Yeah. Are they property? Are they intelligent? Do they have rights? And much...
Wipe their memories. Okay, I guess.
Exactly. Maybe that's a good point to bring up, because that is not a transhuman game, partially because you are not dealing with those themes with the robots.
That's a really good point.
Should have kept a scorecard this episode. Damn it.
Who is arguing with you, dude?
No. I'm just marking down every time someone says, you are right.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, how it'd be pretty difficult to play a game where you've got three or four people exploring what it means to be human, because how do you play that?
Well, I don't know if you actually focus the day-to-day adventure. I mean, you don't sit down and have a philosophical discussion, but you could have different kinds of transhumans in different states of their transhumanism. One person who's only just started to get his first cyberoptic implants, and one person who's, you know, already uploaded themselves dozens of times and are practically a digital intelligence, and maybe the third player is an uplifted octopus, so they are as intelligent as a human but are not human at the same time. And just the way that they interact and go about things. How would you play this if you were an octopus?
I was thinking more the NPCs that they would interact with, and, you know, kind of push the question of, okay, this intelligent robot, you know, these indentured servants, whatever, do they have the same rights as normal people? Like, if this is an artificially grown intelligence and this is like a naturally born human, are they the same thing? Do they have the same rights, and should they be treated the same way?
Especially when the artificial intelligence is smarter than the regular natural human.
Right.
But in a post-human world, do they even think about what is human?
Probably not, Bane.
Probably not.
I just got the look.
I'm glad your wife gave you the look, because I couldn't do it through my screen.
Thankfully, my wife is in bed.
I think it was a good point that you guys made about the transhumanism. And maybe there are transhumans because maybe post-humans wouldn't explore what it means to be human because they're beyond that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Like,
they
think
that need somebody else to interact or react to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in post-humanism, in one way you would define it, everybody's beyond it. So what are they reacting to?
Mm, right.
Whereas transhumanism, people could be in different stages. I think the uplift, which we're going to touch upon a bit more in a later question. I mean, those things are like, are they the equivalent to human clones are a good example. AI right. is a great example. Right. But they're playing off humans.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose you could have post humans visiting, or some sort of, they get separated. I know it's not a big part of BattleTech, but one of the story ideas they threw out in a series that they had was that they've gene-engineered people to live on different environments, and then what's that going to do when you lose touch with them and then you reconnect with them?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And BattleTech is one of those things, science fiction settings that doesn't have an alien race.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, like an equivalent alien race to a human. So meeting a post-human would be like that, but even it would be actually very, very terrifying for the humans.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because maybe that thing is not wrestling with the question, but you're certainly wrestling with the question, is that still human?
Right, right.
Yeah.
No, that's kind of what Mindjammer is set up as. You know, there was a slow ship colonization of the universe. Human beings lost contact with all these colonies, and, you know, a couple millennia later, now we've developed faster-than-light technology and are rediscovering these cultures. So these cultures we are in, or the you know, you're encountering in the setting, used to be human.
Mm-hmm.
Are they still human?
When I read that, I thought that was an interesting premise, and it did remind me of that thing in BattleTech, and that was a very, very small part.
Right.
And it was just thrown out there, hey, maybe you might want to do this if you're going to do space exploration. So I thought that was a pretty intriguing thing to play.
Mm.
Trinity, which was at the series like Adventure, Aberrant, and Trinity.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, you could say the Trinity people are transhuman. They have psionics.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Aberrants come back. And people who don't know the story is like Aberrant was White Wolf's superhero game. So, of course, it's a bit darker.
Mm.
And Trinity takes place after that, and that's more their science fiction game, and the idea is that the superheroes became really aberrant and tried to take over the world, and then China says, okay, we're gonna nuke the whole planet, and because it's China, they believe them, and they go off into space, and now they're sort of coming back, or at least humans have expanded, so then now they're meeting these aberrants who are post-human, and the Trinity people would be transhuman. So
right.
That some interesting questions there that you could ask yourself.
Mm-hmm. You bring all this up, and us discussing this, I'm wondering if you could actually play a truly post-human game. Because, as you said, we
tried an eclipse phase, and I think and just in that episode, we certainly wrestled with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was left thinking that we certainly didn't play a post-human game. We played...
Oh, you mean we the players?
We the players. We played a game that had post-humanism.
Okay.
Because we were focusing on the adventure, and of course it was a new game, so the rules.
Right.
Right.
And nothing really got explored, and it was very, very hard. We didn't know each other, and maybe those are some things that you need to do, is maybe you can't do a traditional game with everybody just make a character, and then we'll bring you all together. Maybe you have to say, okay, you're all going to be together somehow, because you're going to be comfortable with each other, because you got to be comfortable for you to explore stuff.
Right.
You've got to react to other stuff. I don't know.
Hmm. The thing that was difficult about it is just the amount of information. How much information post-humans have is just almost beyond the imagination for us. You think about it, they would have perfect recall of anything and everything that they've ever learned or done before. And with some kind of super mesh internet thing, any information that they want to know, there would be some kind of Wikipedia, but they could probably have it near instantaneously downloaded into their brains. It's right. One of those things where we were starting to investigate some kind of mystery during the Eclipse Phase game, and we had to go and do research on things and look stuff up, but a post-human wouldn't. They would say, all right, I want to know about the third moon of Jupiter, and then, bam, I know it.
Yeah, intellectually or physically, like, I'm sure I could play a cat creature.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Battlelords of the 23rd century, right. Or I could play an elf, or I can play, you know, a variety of different things, but I don't change my body in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, oh, I'm putting myself in, and I'm an orc, and, you know, this is how an orc would react, or I'm a Klingon. But there, it's just, this is a body, and I'm going to discard this body, and now I'm something else. So what am I? I'm code in a machine that's just getting transferred, and things like that is... Sounds interesting, and if you wrote a novel, could be really interesting to read, or sorry, if you read a novel, it could be interesting to read because the one person is orchestrating everything and all the thinking, but playing that? Because when we're in the game Eclipse phase, we're sleeping, but we just need to do things, or we need to go from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose as post-humans, we're like, well, that's the way you just travel.
Mm-hmm. Just change clothes.
And but for us, should we be reacting to that?
Exactly.
Or should we just be going, oh, well, that's just the way we travel. And is that playing post-humanism? Or sorry, is that exploring post-humanism? Or is that just, I'm just playing a game that happens to have it?
Yeah, good point. I was thinking like it would be hard to play a post-human game only because we as players do not know what post-human means, because we are not post-human, and therefore how could you play it? Where playing a transhuman game, you still identify, your character would still identify as being human. And so therefore we could play it. Like, who knows what form a post-human would take? Like you said, Chris, you might have some kind of like instantaneous mesh interface where you could learn about the one of the moons of Jupiter. Like, for all I know, a post-human could actually just say, I want to go there and instantaneously be there.
Yeah, theoretically.
So, yeah, theoretically. So I think...
Or download the entire memories of someone who's lived there their entire
life.
Right,
exactly. Who knows what a post-human could do? So I think part of the problem was, yeah, as you said, Chris, Eclipse Phase was a lot of information, but it was a lot of mechanical information where...
Yeah.
It could have just been, here's all the things you can do, and you don't need stats or mechanics or anything for it because you are post-human and you can just do it.
Mm-hmm.
It might not be that fun to play from a game perspective, but...
Even a transhuman game and where you identify as being human, but I think about RoboCop, just because I watched the remake recently, but that's a story about one RoboCop, and... You know, is he still human or is he not? And what about his family? But if you have like 3 RoboCops or 4 RoboCops at the table, do you want to just play game, the game and fight crime in Detroit? Or do you take turns lamenting your lack of humanity?
Right.
You know, it's like one of, you can tell the story, but yeah, or even the Changing Game. It's just like, oh, I've got these memories. And I was like, yeah, but we got stuff to do.
Right.
Oh, yeah,
right.
But am I still human? I don't know. Just, we got stuff to do. Yeah.
I think...
Is it my turn to be mopey? Yes.
Right. No, that's a really good point. And I think that's why, if I was focusing on this question, or if I was including this question in the game, I would have it be a question that the NPCs kind of asked. Because as you said, Lyle, the players are going to want to do stuff and not sit around and navel gaze and wonder what it is to be human. So I would kind of have that be the background question just through the type of NPCs that the players interacted with.
Or you could have those interactions lead into that question. I can't think of a good example for the life of me right now, but a fantasy example of that is when you're slaughtering through the whole dungeon and killing all of the orcs in there, and then you get to the baby room, where there's a whole bunch of quote-unquote innocent
room.
Baby orcs. Yeah. Yeah. You've had that encounter. Everybody has,
I
sure.
know exactly what you're talking about. I just never heard it called the baby room before.
the orc and baby room.
The nursery.
I think, yeah. The nursery, yeah, that's the actual word.
Right.
If you want to use correct terminology. But, yeah, and then the players sometimes have a discussion about whether it's correct or not to kill innocent babies, and even though they're orcs and they'll grow up to be orcs and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So.
You bring that up raises a really good point where this is probably something you should discuss with your players beforehand, because using that fantasy analogy, if players get blindsided by, you asking that moral question as GM, some of them might not like it, where it's like, I thought we were just kind of playing a lighthearted dungeon crawl where we're expected to slaughter these orc babies because they're orcs, and we kind of weren't prepared for this moral question. So I think that's something you could, or probably should, discuss beforehand if you're going to do a transhuman game.
Yeah, there's no point in exploring that thing if all the players want to do is see the cool cyberware they get and what kind of guns they can access.
Or it could be the opposite, where you have guys bust into the room with guns, and all the players do is like, oh, go ahead and kill me, because we're just sitting here thinking about what it means to be human.
I'm sorry, they've got a backup, so it doesn't matter anyway.
Right.
Well.
All right. Well, since we touched upon it, the next question is, who or what is being uplifted?
Octopi!
Yeah, so... Are you being transformed into an octopus, or has the octopus been uplifted to be as intelligent or more intelligent than a human?
Or have they risen up against their land-dwelling oppressors?
Much like Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, I mean, Uplift, we took that from the David Brin series.
Which are... Mm. I really enjoyed those first couple books.
Yeah, so did I. Yeah, mm-hmm. They had the uplifted chimpanzees, mm-hmm. the uplifted gorillas, and dolphins.
Yep, dolphins. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are really cool.
There's a really good webcomic that I used to read called Freefall, where it's one of the characters is an uplifted wolf for it. And one of the points they bring up is that chimpanzees are too violent creatures. They don't get along well enough. They're too much like humans. So that's why they uplifted wolves and dogs instead, because they naturally get along with people.
I can see that.
Yeah, chimpanzees are pretty violent.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
What I liked about David Brin's choice about the dolphin is that you still have to account for the fact that it's a dolphin's body.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And how it functions. Like, so it's got to be in the water and it swims around. So it's not like they've just attached arms and legs to a dolphin head.
Yeah, when they did like mechanical repairs, I believe they had to like swim into a harness that had, you know, remote controlled arms to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But like the entire spaceship they were on was mostly filled with water because, hey, they're dolphins.
Yeah, I can't remember what was the point of having dolphins to do that ship.
I think the sea mammal thing kind of helped in zero-G gravity because they're used to moving in three dimensions.
Oh, okay.
I might be wrong, but I think that's the thing I remember being. But no, you mentioning that, you know, you liking the fact that they were still dolphin's body. I mean, part of the reason I said I didn't want Chris to play an octopus in that one shot of Eclipse phase we played is because the brain of whatever uplifted your animal you're playing is still going to be, or still going to retain stuff about what it means to be that animal. Otherwise, you're just playing a human.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, an uplifted dolphin is still going to think like a dolphin. An uplifted chimpanzee is still going to think like a chimpanzee, just much more intelligently. And that's also why I like the David Brin novels, because the uplifted animals did weird, from a human perspective, things, because they were still animals.
Yeah, I remember what the dolphins did. I don't remember the chimpanzee. I just remember the one chimpanzee.
You know, that's kind of what I wrestle with playing a transhuman or uplifted game.
Well, if you uplifted an animal, he'd just be really curious, wouldn't he? Like, aren't they good escape artists or something?
Right, really. Well, they're solitary creatures, and they aren't aggressive. They usually flee from any kind of danger.
Yeah, mad about the World Cup. Definitely. Good figure. Right. I could have them always betting on stuff and getting it right.
Or opening jars that they get stuck inside of. I don't know. I kind of saw that as our mantra. If you're going to bring it in, make it matter. Where my feeling is, if you're just going to play it as a human, then why are you bothering to play an uplifted animal? Maybe like throw a couple quirks into your character to do that.
I would have.
Yeah. There's that. You guys mentioned about AI. I mean, that would be appropriate in the game, or you know, the robots. And...
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'd be even harder to play, because you wouldn't really have anything to model that on. Whereas, you know, playing an uplifted animal, you could look at the actual animal and pick out some characteristics.
You get a lot of examples in fiction.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's all you're really going with. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Unless you're playing Google. Now, I was reading a pretty interesting article about how we already have AI in the world today, and most of it is programmed by Google. And they're talking about the GPS systems and Google's map route finder, that they intelligently find routes through maps better, faster than humans can. So it's a very limited form of artificial intelligence, but it is artificial intelligence nonetheless.
Well, there's the quirk to pick out. Nope, why are we going this way? I can do this much better and faster than you.
You know, that would be something to do with the AI. It's not that they're smarter in all aspects, but they're really smart in, like, a few aspects.
Right. So. Well, from a game perspective, that's also kind of a way to limit them and make sure that that character doesn't overshadow everybody else, because you are playing with a group, and so everybody kind of has to have their moments to shine.
Yep. And that's the other character you wouldn't let me play in Eclipse Phase.
Okay. The list is out there. I wanted to focus on the horror thing, and I thought neither an AI nor an octopus would react the same way a human would to fear. So that's also the reason why I wouldn't let Chris play a disembodied infomorph that was just information in the computer system.
What about aliens?
Those were off the table, too.
No, but, okay, not aliens, but the movie Aliens.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
Yeah, with the...
What are you talking about? Ash?
Bishop. He is what? Bishop was a replicant? No, I want to say replicant, but that's Blade Runner.
He was a synthetic. He was a synthetic. Yeah.
Synthetic, thank you. And it's not that he knows fear, but he does have, like, self-preservation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's things you can do and I haven't seen Prometheus, but I imagine that kind of blank wooden acting is because he was a synthetic.
I would like to think so, but like Lance Henriksen did a much better job. You're like, hold on, are those the same model or whatever? But anyway.
Oh, you know, that's funny, and this comes up in like Star Wars. It's like the level of technology, where it's like, hey, even though this is before, the technology seems to be much better.
Things are everything is cleaner, brighter, fancier, nicer, which kind of leads us to our next question about, is your setting a utopian, dystopian, or neither?
Yeah, I think a lot of the settings go for dystopia.
Mm-hmm. I think because it's not that much drama in Utopia, usually.
Well, I mean, you could do, like, the Time Machines, where it appears to be a utopia, but it really isn't.
It's actually a dystopia.
Well, I mentioned
I think you saw what I was doing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a hidden dystopia.
Yeah.
But you could do the... I mean, I think there's some, like, science fiction where it is a utopia. But there's problems with it. Maybe Demolition Man. I know that's not necessarily a transhuman or posthumanism story, but
everything's no, I see what you're saying. Yeah,
going again. That's the thing where you need somebody to react to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, hey, this is what you've lost. So, I mean, is Logan's Run a dystopia? If the first 30 years are a utopia.
Good point. It's a very philosophical question.
Well, and this gets into the immortality. I mean. That's not exclusively the goal of transhumanism or posthumanism, but certainly one of them.
Mm.
But if you have everybody being immortal, and I think Transhuman Space explores this, that was a GURPS game, where the generation gap becomes like a huge gulf because people are just living so much longer, and then you know you're not necessarily replacing people in their roles, so what do you do with that?
Mm-hmm.
So is that a utopia that everybody's living in? You know, what is there a downside or?
I mentioned the culture novels before, and when I picked up the first culture novel I read, it seemed pretty boring because the culture is a utopia, right? Like it's a post scarcity utopia, meaning that nobody has to work, everybody's needs are provided for, people live pretty much indefinitely, they can do whatever they want, and on the surface that seemed really boring. So the conflict kind of always happened outside of the culture, outside of culture space. It was, okay, you belong to the culture, and for whatever reason, you're going to go and have to interact with these other non-culture people. And so things are going to be radically different. That could get kind of boring if you kept doing it again and again and again, but that is a way to do, I guess, kind of a utopian transhuman game where everything in our society is great. Now go deal with these other people who are not part of it.
No, but I mean, that's a good point. Just the boredom factor is that for some reason, there are certain people and the player characters being one of them, they get bored in this society. They shouldn't because it's a perfect society.
Mm.
But they, I mean, there's something, and this could be a way to explore the post-humanism or sort of what it means to be human is that humans need conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And that's now absent. And I think that's touched on in Matrix, where they say they can't have a utopia.
Right, the first Matrix you tried was utopia. It was a disaster.
Yeah. Right, because human beings, their brain just kind of rejected it, yeah.
Yeah, so they need some sort of conflict. I'm also thinking of, not necessarily people getting bored, but I'm also thinking of The Ilium and by Dan Simmons again, where it's a utopia, but it's got strange rules.
Mm.
And some people do start to question why did they have these rules, and then that can lead to an interesting story.
Right.
I mean, it's probably not going to be like one that you keep repeating, because once you find out the mystery, then that's probably the end. But so, oh, but I have another question. Oh, okay, really? Right. Well, let's explore this one. Yeah. But then they probably are going to change it where they actually. Not like drag it down from being a utopia to being something more normal, or from our perspective,
right?
As flawed humans.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of interesting.
That could be your thing. Is like, yeah, we're transhuman, posthuman, but let's bring us down to humanity.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Luddites have it good.
And one of the trends in transhumanism is called abolitionism. And the idea is its goal is to eliminate involuntary suffering in all sentient life, to the point where, in some cases, they want to remove the body's ability to respond to pain, where to make it human beings or transhumans incapable of experiencing pain and suffering. The kind of like a forced happiness. And they say if you remove those things, you know, society would be maybe not perfect, but much better off. And that's kind of scary.
And then again, that question then is somebody who can't feel sadness or pain, human.
Right, exactly. Or would you even know? But, you know, this talk about everybody being completely happy in this utopian society made me think of that, where maybe the reason is because people are genetically engineered or conditioned so that they cannot feel dissatisfaction.
What if they eliminate sadness and then they find out that there's no happiness, because happiness needs to be a reaction to something?
Well, would they ever know, because they can't experience sadness?
I just feel this. See, again, that would be, I think, would play a little bit better if the player characters are reacting to that.
Right, yeah, rather than doing it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they encounter these post-humans. And I guess it's kind of like a Star Trek. They go down to the world and like, oh, yes, we just eat these fruits and everybody's happy. And then it's like, oh, you're also young. Yes.
You know, I think a good way to approach a post-human game might be from an outsider's perspective. Something where, I don't know, the player's consciousness is something more modern or something more relatable to like actual human beings, and kind of then introduce them into the post-human society so they can react to all the different things about it.
Oh, here's the thing. There's a new fad in this post-human world where they get code from like people, like actual humans, and then they upload that into their brain, or they accidentally upload like a human's brain. And now they think like a human as opposed to a post-human, and now...
Oh, yeah. Erase everything down to the base level.
No, but then they're just like, what kind of world am I in now? But they've got like this strange sleeve. So then there's a case where the human is reacting to everything, that it is very strange and messed up because they're not used to it. Like, they just suddenly got uploaded or reawakened, in a sense, as code in somebody's head. Yeah.
I was thinking the other way you could do it is, like Chris said, is to play the other. You know, instead of being the culture who is colonizing the universe and kind of re-meeting all these human descendants, you're one of those lost groups, and transhumans are, you know, contacting you. Although that becomes kind of more like an invasion, or could end up being like an invasion.
Especially if they're post-humans, because you're being invaded by something that maybe once was, but is no longer human.
Yeah, again, kind of raise the question of, would post-humans even care to contact things that are still humanity anymore?
Well, it depends. I mean, if it was something where there had been a separation between them, so these post-humans are coming back to their ancestral territories, you know, these creatures are what we used to be. So there would be an interest there, I reckon.
So let's just carpet bomb them with whatever new advanced technology we have, because...
Or put them in zoos.
They're no longer us. Yep.
Or like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where they just try to take them over. Yeah, they could try to convert them and change them, like forcibly doing it.
Right.
And that's another way to take it then for the player characters. You know, you have been changed into a post-human, but this is your first day at it.
Or you're just running and escaping from it, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they're gathering up humans to change them to post-humans, to save them, to uplift them.
I know that The Host was written by Stephanie Meyer, so it's already pretty bad. But the movie was actually decent, especially considering who wrote it, and that's exactly what it was. I mean, the things were called like an alien that essentially, you know, took over people's bodies, and the entire world was overrun except for these, you know, small resistance groups. But they totally could have been post-humans. And at the end, it's just kind of like they can communicate, and you know, with human beings. And it was just like, well, you're kind of the first species to ever resist this, and you're the first species that we ever experienced to, we kind of have this imperfect, you know, symbiosis with. And in that case, it was kind of boredom on the entity's part, which is like, nope, just kind of travel around the galaxy, you know, jumping into different things' bodies to experience them because we live for so long and are so incredibly bored.
So that ends our episode on transhumanism or posthumanism. And just some questions to ask yourself before you run one of these types of games. And one of them is your game about transhumanism or about posthumanism? And another question is your game about these humanisms, or does it just have it in the game?
As a setting.
Like, are you going to explore what it means to be human, in other words?
Right.
Who or what is being uplifted in your world? Is your society utopian, dystopian, or neither, or it doesn't matter?
Just plain old topian.
Topian. Tope. It's the top. And that said, I mean, even if you're playing an existing game that tells itself as transhuman, such as Eclipse Phase or Transhuman Space, or you're playing a game that doesn't necessarily advertise it, such as Trinity or a cyberpunk game or Shadowrun, it doesn't mean that you can't or have to explore the issues. I mean, just play the game to have fun.
Absolutely.
I agree. All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idlereredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Farewell.
Oh, jeez.
We gotta do an episode of just Bane voices.
I agree.
An hour and 20 minutes later, that joke still hasn't died.
Is your game... Okay, when I read it like this, they sound the same.
All right, and I'll put the sign off there. And
sure you want to do this? I could do it as Bane.
That's all right. You know what? Go ahead and do it. It'll be the outtake.
All right.
Thank you for joining us again on Idle Red Hands. You can check us out online at www.idlereredhands.com. Idleredhands.com.
What else? It's been so long since I've done it now.
Well, I think Bane's kind of got like more of an English accent, not just glass.
You can see us online at www.
You did kind of fade into like announcer there a little bit.
I was actually going Australian for a second there by accident.
Check us out online. Yeah, never mind.
Now, we all know that Australian accent is really just shouting.
Drive-through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-through RPG. The one true source for RPGs.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.